the American answered with a shrug of the shoulders. If the driver says so, then we can get across.
Sure, continued Passepartout. We'll get across, but it might be more sensible.
What? Sensible?
Exclaimed Colonel Proctor, who jumped at the mention of this word, which he'd accidentally overheard.
Do you understand? At full speed!
I know, I understand,
repeated Passepartout, unable to finish his sentence.
But it might be, if not more sensible, since you find the word offensive, then let's just say more natural.
Who? What? What's he on about with his natural?
People shouted from all quarters. The poor fellow didn't know what to do to make people listen to him.
Are you afraid?
Colonel Proctor asked him.
Me? Afraid? Exclaimed Passepartout.
Well, that's it. I'll show this lot that the Frenchmen can be just as American as they are.
Back into the carriages, back into the carriages,
shouted the conductor.
Yes, back into the carriages,
repeated Passepartout.
Back into the carriages and quick about it. But I still can't help thinking that it would have been more natural to make us passengers go across the bridge first on foot and get the train across afterwards.
But no one heard these sensible words, and no one would have wanted to admit how right Passepartout was. The passengers were back in their carriages. Passepartout sat down in his seat again without saying a word about what had gone on. The card players were completely absorbed in their game of whist. The locomotive gave a vigorous blast on its whistle. The driver reversed the engine and took the train back about a mile, like a jumper stepping backward in order to have a better run. Then there was a second blast on the whistle, and the train began to move forward again. It accelerated, and soon the speed was terrifying. All that could be heard was the roaring of the locomotive. The pistons were pumping away 20 times a second. The wheel axles were giving off smoke from their grease boxes. It seemed as if the whole train, which was traveling at 100 miles an hour, was no longer touching the rails. Its speed defied gravity.
And they got across. It was like a flash of lightning. They saw nothing of the bridge. The train leapt, so to speak, from one bank to the other,
and the driver managed to bring the runaway machine to a halt 5 miles past the station. But the train had barely crossed the river when the bridge, now damaged beyond repair, collapsed with an enormous crash into the rapids of Medicine Bow. Chapter 29, in which various incidents will be recounted that could only have occurred on a railroad in America. That same evening, the train continued its journey unhindered, got beyond Fort Saunders, crossed the Cheyenne Pass, and reached Evans Pass. It was here that the railroad reached its highest point, 8,091 feet above sea level. All that remained was for the travelers to go on down to the Atlantic over those endless plains that nature has leveled flat. This was also where the Great Trunk Line branched off to Denver City, the largest town in Colorado. This territory is rich in gold and silver mines, and more than 50,000 people have already settled there. By then, they had covered 1,382 miles since San Francisco, and it had taken them 3 days and three nights. 4 days and four nights should be enough, according to the best estimates, to reach New York. Phileas Fogg was, therefore, still within his deadline. During the night, the train went past Camp Walback to its left. Lodgepole Creek ran parallel to the railway line, along the border that runs in a straight line between the states of Wyoming and Colorado. At 11 o'clock, it entered Nebraska, passed close to Sedgwick, and reached Julesburg, which is situated on the South Platte River. It is here that the Union Pacific Railroad, whose chief engineer was General G.M. Dodge, was inaugurated on the 23rd of October, 1867. This was where the two powerful locomotives stopped on that day, pulling their 9 carriages of distinguished guests, including the vice president of the railroad, Mr. Thomas C. Durant. This was where the crowd gathered and cheered, and where the Sioux and Pawnees gave a demonstration of their fighting skills. This was where they held a firework display, and lastly, where they published the first issue of the Railway Pioneer magazine by means of a portable printing press. This was how they celebrated the inauguration of this great railway, an instrument of progress and civilization which conquered the wilderness and was destined to link up towns and cities that hadn't yet been built. The locomotive's whistle, more powerful than Amphion's lyre, would soon make them spring up on American soil. At 8 o'clock in the morning, the train left behind Fort McPherson. Omaha was 357 miles away. The railway line followed the left bank of the South Platte River, with all its unpredictable twists and turns. At 9 o'clock, the train reached the important town of North Platte, built between the two branches of this great river, which then join up around the town to form a single waterway, an important tributary whose waters flow into the Missouri a short distance above Omaha. They had crossed the 101st meridian. Mr. Fogg and his partners had started playing cards again. None of them complained about the length of the journey, not even the dummy. At the beginning, Fix won a few guineas, which he was in the process of losing again, but he was just as keen on the game as Mr. Fogg. During the morning, the gentleman had been unusually lucky. He kept receiving trumps and honors in his hands. At one point, after thinking up a daring move, he was preparing to play spades, when from behind where he was sitting, he heard a voice say,
"If it was me, I'd play diamonds."
Mr. Fogg, Mrs. Ayuda, and Fix looked up. Colonel Proctor was standing next to them. Stamp W. Proctor and Phileas Fogg recognized each other immediately.
"Oh, it's you, the Englishman," exclaimed the colonel. "You're the one who wants to play spades."
"And that's exactly what I'm about to do," Phileas Fogg replied coldly, putting down a 10 of that suit.
"Well, I think it should be a diamond," retorted the colonel in an annoyed tone of voice.
And for a moment it looked as if he was going to grab the card that had been played, adding,
"You haven't a clue about this game."
"Perhaps I'll be better at another sort of game," said Phileas Fogg, getting to his feet.
"It's just up to you if you want to try, you bloody Englishman,"
the vulgar character replied. Mrs. Ayuda had become very pale. She looked as if she was going to faint. She had grabbed Mr. Fogg by the arm, but he gently pushed her back. Passepartout was ready to throw himself at the American, who was giving his opponent a very dirty look. But Fix had got to his feet, went over to Colonel Proctor, saying,
"You're forgetting that I'm the one you have to deal with, my dear sir. I'm the one you not only insulted, but hit."
"Mr. Fix," said Mr. Fogg, "I beg your pardon, but this matter concerns only me. By claiming that I was wrong to play spades, the colonel has insulted me a second time, and he will have to answer for it."
"Whenever you like and wherever you like," replied the American, "and you can choose the weapon."
Mrs. Ayuda attempted in vain to restrain Mr. Fogg. The inspector tried unsuccessfully to bring the argument back to himself. Passepartout wanted to throw the colonel out through the door, but a sign from his master stopped him. Phileas Fogg went out of the carriage, and the American followed him onto the platform. "Sir," Mr. Fogg said to his opponent, "I am in a great hurry to return to Europe, and any delay would have serious consequences for me."
"So, what's that got to do with me?" retorted Colonel Proctor.
"Sir," Mr. Fogg replied very politely, "after our encounter in San Francisco, I had planned to return to America to meet up with you again as soon as I'd sorted out the matters that require my attention back in the old world."
"Really?
Will you agree to meet me in 6 months' time?"
"Why not, in that case, 6 years?"
"I said 6 months," answered Mr. Fogg, "and I shall be there exactly on time."
"You're just looking for excuses," exclaimed Stamp W. Proctor. "It's now or never."
"Very well," replied Mr. Fogg. "Are you going to New York?"
"No."
"To Chicago?"
"No."
"To Omaha?"
"That's nothing to do with you. Do you know Plum Creek?"
"No," answered Mr. Fogg.
"It's the next station. The train will be there in an hour's time. It stops for 10 minutes. 10 minutes is enough time to exchange a few shots with a revolver."
"Fine," replied Mr. Fogg. "I'll get off at Plum Creek."
"And I reckon you won't be getting back on again,"
added the American, with breathtaking insolence.
"Who knows, my dear sir," answered Mr. Fogg.
and he went back into the carriage looking as unemotional as usual. Once he was inside, the first thing he did was to reassure Mrs. Ayuda by saying that loud mouths were never people to be afraid of. Then he asked Fix to act as his second in the encounter that was to take place. Fix couldn't say no, and Phileas Fogg then calmly went back to the unfinished game of cards and quite nonchalantly played spades. At 11 o'clock, the locomotive blew its whistle to announce that they were about to arrive in Plum Creek. Mr. Fogg got up and, with Fix following him, went onto the platform. Passepartout accompanied him, carrying a pair of revolvers. Mrs. Ayuda remained inside the carriage, looking as pale as death. At that moment, the door of the other carriage opened, and Colonel Proctor also appeared on the platform, followed by his second, a Yankee in the same mold. But just as the two protagonists were about to go down on the track, the conductor rushed up to them, shouting,
"You mustn't get out, gentlemen."
"And why not?"
asked the colonel.
"We're 20 minutes late, so the train isn't stopping."
"But I need to fight this gentleman."
"I'm sorry," said the official, "but we are leaving again immediately. You can hear the bell ringing now."
The bell was indeed ringing, and the train set off again.
"I really am very sorry, gentlemen,"
the conductor then said.
"In any other circumstances, I could have obliged. But after all, since you haven't had time to fight it out here, what's to stop you from doing so when the train's on the move?"
"Perhaps that wouldn't suit, sir,"
Colonel Proctor said with a sneer.
"That suits me perfectly," replied Fogg.
"Well, this really is America for you," thought Passepartout. "And this train conductor is a real gentleman."
With this, he followed his master. The two protagonists and their seconds, preceded by the conductor, walked through the carriages until they reached the back of the train. There were only about a dozen passengers in the last carriage. The conductor asked them if they would be so kind as to vacate the area for a few moments to enable two gentlemen to settle a matter of honor. Why, of course. The passengers were only too happy to oblige the two gentlemen, and so they withdrew onto the platforms. The carriage, which was about 50 feet long, was ideal for the purpose. The two protagonists could advance upon each other between the seats and could blunderbuss each other at leisure. There had never been an easier duel to arrange. Mr. Fogg and Colonel Proctor, each equipped with 2 6-chamber revolvers, entered the carriage. Their seconds, who remained outside, locked them in. At the first blast on the whistle, they were to begin firing. Then, after a period of 2 minutes, what remained of the two gentlemen would be removed from the carriage. There really could be nothing simpler. It was even so simple that Fix and Passepartout felt their hearts beating as if they were going to burst. So they were waiting for the agreed signal on the whistle, when suddenly wild shouts rang out, accompanied by the sound of firing. But it was not coming from the carriage reserved for the duelists. The firing ran instead along the whole length of the train down to the front. Screams of terror could be heard coming from inside the train. Colonel Proctor and Mr. Fogg, with revolvers at the ready, immediately left the carriage and rushed towards the front of the train, where the loudest noises of firing and shouting were coming from. They had realized that the train was being attacked by a band of Sioux warriors. This was certainly not the first time members of this daring tribe had attempted to attack, and already, on more than one occasion, they had held up trains. Following their usual plan, and without waiting for the train to come to a standstill, about 100 of them had leapt onto the footboards and clambered onto the carriages like circus clowns jumping onto galloping horses. The Sioux were equipped with rifles, hence the noise of firing, to which the passengers, almost all of whom were armed, replied by using their revolvers. At first, the warriors had stormed the engine. The driver and the fireman had been hit with clubs and were only semi-conscious. A Sioux chief attempted to stop the train, but because he didn't know how to operate the throttle control, he had opened up the steam instead of closing it, and the runaway train was rushing ahead at a terrifying speed. At the same time, the Sioux had swarmed onto the carriages and were running along the roofs like enraged monkeys, knocking down the doors and engaging in hand-to-hand combat with the passengers. The luggage van had been broken into and ransacked, and the contents strewn along the track. The shouting and firing kept on and on. However, the passengers defended themselves with great courage.
Some carriages, with their passengers barricaded inside, withstood the siege like mobile forts that were being carried along at a speed of 100 miles an hour. From the moment the attack had begun, Mrs. Ayuda had behaved courageously. With a revolver in her hand, she defended herself heroically, firing through the broken window whenever a savage appeared in front of her. About 20 fatally wounded Sioux had fallen onto the line, and the wheels of the carriages squashed like worms those who slid from the platforms onto the rails. Several passengers who had been seriously injured by the bullets or the clubs were lying on the seats. However, things couldn't go on like this. The fighting had already raged for 10 minutes, and the Sioux would inevitably be the victors if the train didn't come to a stop. The station at Fort Kearney was less than 2 miles away and contained an American garrison, but after that the Sioux would be in complete control of the train until the next station along the line. The conductor was fighting next to Mr. Fogg when he was struck by a bullet. As he fell down, he cried out,
"We've had it if the train doesn't stop within the next 5 minutes."
"It will stop," said Phileas Fogg, eager to rush out of the carriage.
"Stay here, sir,"
Passepartout shouted to him.
"I'm the one for this."
Phileas Fogg had no time to stop the brave fellow, who opened the door without being seen by the Sioux and managed to slide below the carriage. And then, while the fighting continued and the bullets flew in all directions above his head, with all the old agility and nimbleness of his time in the circus, he slithered along under the carriages. Holding onto the chains, using to support himself the brake levers and the underframes of the carriages, crawling with great skill from one carriage to the next, he succeeded in reaching the front of the train. He hadn't been seen. He couldn't have been. Hanging by one hand between the luggage van and the tender, he used his other hand to unhook the safety chains. But because of the force of traction, he would never have managed to undo the coupling pin if a sudden jolt of the engine hadn't released it, so that the carriages, detached from the engine, were gradually left behind, while the locomotives sped ahead even faster. Carried along by its own momentum, the train continued to advance for a few more minutes. But the brakes were applied from inside the carriages, and the train at last came to a standstill, less than 100 yards from the station in Kearney. There, the noise of the firing had alerted the soldiers, who came running towards the train. The Sioux hadn't waited for them, and before the train had come to a complete halt, the whole band had cleared off. But when the passengers checked if they were all there, as they stood on the station platform, they realized that several of their number were missing, and one of those was the brave Frenchman to whose selflessness they owed their lives. Chapter 30, in which Phileas Fogg quite simply does his duty. 3 passengers, one of whom was Passepartout, had disappeared. Had they been killed in the struggle? Had they been taken prisoner by the Sioux? It was too early to tell. There were quite a large number of wounded, but it was clear that none of the injuries were fatal. One of those most seriously wounded was Colonel Proctor, who had fought courageously and had been struck by a bullet in the groin. He was transported to the station, along with other passengers who required immediate treatment for their wounds. Mrs. Ayuda was safe. Phileas Fogg, who had given his all, hadn't suffered a scratch. Fix was wounded in the arm, but it wasn't serious. But Passepartout was missing, and the young woman had tears in her eyes. Meanwhile, all the passengers had got out of the train. The wheels of the carriages were stained with blood. The mangled remains of bodies were hanging from the hubs and spokes. There were long trails of red stretching across the white plain as far as the eye could see. The last of the assailants were still disappearing towards the south, towards Republican River. Mr. Fogg remained motionless, arms folded. He had a crucial decision to make. Mrs. Ayuda was at his side and was looking at him without saying a word. He understood the meaning of her expression. If his servant had been taken prisoner, then shouldn't he risk everything to rescue him from the Sioux? "I shall find him, dead or alive," was all he said to Mrs. Ayuda.
"Oh, sir, Mr. Fogg,"
the young woman exclaimed, grasping her companion's hands, onto which her tears rolled. "Alive," added Mr. Fogg, "providing we don't waste any time." In making this decision, Phileas Fogg was sacrificing everything. He had just condemned himself to financial ruin. A single day's delay meant he would miss the steamer from New York. His bet was irretrievably lost. But at the thought of, "This is my duty," he had not hesitated. The captain in command of Fort Kearney was there. His soldiers, about 100 men in all, had taken up defensive positions in the event of the Sioux launching a direct attack on the station. "Officer," said Mr. Fogg to the captain, "three passengers are missing."
"Presumed dead?" asked the captain.
"Dead or captured," replied Phileas Fogg. "We need to find out which is the case. Is your plan to go after the Sioux?"
"This is serious business, sir," said the captain. "They may flee beyond the Arkansas River. I just can't abandon the fort I'm in charge of."
"Sir," continued Phileas Fogg, "the lives of three men are at stake."
"That may be so, but can I risk the lives of 50 men to save three?"
"I don't know whether you can, sir, but you must."
"Sir," replied the captain, "no one here tells me my duty."
"Right," said Phileas Fogg coldly. "I shall go alone."
"You, sir?"
cried out Fix, who had got closer.
"Going after the Sioux, all on your own?"
"Do you really expect me to leave this unfortunate man to die when everyone here owes their life to him? I intend to go."
"Well, in that case, you won't be going alone," exclaimed the captain, overcome with emotion in spite of himself. "No, you are a man of courage. I want 30 volunteers," he added, turning towards his soldiers.
The whole company stepped forward to a man. All the captain had to do was to take his pick from these fine fellows. 30 soldiers were selected, and a wise old sergeant put in charge.
"Thank you, Captain," said Mr. Fogg.
"Will you allow me to come with you?" Fix asked the gentleman.
"You may do as you wish, sir," Phileas Fogg said to him in reply. "But if you really do want to do something to help me, then you should stay with Mrs. Aouda in the event of something happening to me."
The police inspector's face suddenly went very pale. How could he let go of this man who he had followed so doggedly and with such persistence? How could he let him venture into the wilderness like this? Fix looked at the gentleman intently, and despite himself, for all his feelings against Fogg, and in spite of the struggle that was going on inside him, he felt uncomfortable when confronted with that calm and honest expression.
"I shall stay here," he said.
A few moments later, Mr. Fogg shook the young woman's hand, and then, after handing her his precious travel bag, he was ready to leave with the sergeant and his small troop of men. But before leaving, he said to the soldiers, "My friends, there's a reward of £1,000 waiting for you if we rescue the prisoners." By then, it was a few minutes past midday. Mrs. Aouda had withdrawn to a room in the station, where she proceeded to wait on her own, thinking of Phileas Fogg and his simple but noble generosity and his quiet strength of character. Mr. Fogg had given up his fortune, and now he was risking his life. And he had done all this without hesitation, out of a sense of duty, and without false rhetoric. Phileas Fogg was a hero in her eyes. Inspector Fix wasn't of the same opinion, and he was unable to control his inner turmoil. He walked up and down along the station platform, looking agitated. After momentarily being under the gentleman's power, he then became his old self again. Once Fogg had set off, he realized how foolish he had been to let him go. How on earth could he have agreed to be separated from this man who he had been following around the world? His true nature reasserted itself. He blamed and criticized himself. He told himself off as if he was the head of the Metropolitan Police, reprimanding a member of his force, caught out by his own naivete.
"What a fool I've been," he thought. "His other half will have told him who I am. He's gone, and he won't be back. Where can I get my hands on him again now? How on earth could I have let myself be taken in like this? Me, Fix, when I've got his arrest warrant in my pocket? Oh, I really must be stupid."
These were the thoughts going through the police inspector's mind as the hours went by, all too slowly for his liking.
He didn't know what to do. At times he wanted to tell Mrs. Ayuda everything, but he realized what her reaction would be. What should he decide? He was tempted to set off across the long snow-covered plains in pursuit of Fogg. He thought he would stand some chance of finding him. The footmarks of the detachment of soldiers were still visible in the snow. But soon their traces disappeared under a fresh fall. Fix suddenly became despondent. He felt a sort of irresistible urge to give up the whole game. In fact, the opportunity to leave the station at Kearney and continue this journey, which had brought him so many disappointments, was about to present itself. What happened was that at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, as the snow fell in heavy flakes, long blasts on a whistle could be heard coming from the east. A huge shadow, preceded by a yellowish glow, was moving slowly forward, made to look even bigger by the fog that gave it a ghostly appearance. However, no train was expected yet from the east. The help requested by telegraph could not have arrived so soon, and the train from Omaha to San Francisco wasn't due to arrive until the following day. The explanation soon became clear. This locomotive that was moving forward so slowly, letting out loud blasts on the whistle, was the one that, after being uncoupled from the train, had continued to run at such a terrifying speed, taking with it the fireman and the driver, who were both unconscious. It had gone on for a few miles, but then the fire had died down because of a lack of fuel. The steam had given out, and an hour later, after gradually slowing down, the engine at last came to a halt about 20 miles beyond the station at Kearney. Both the driver and the fireman were still alive, and, after being unconscious for a considerable time, they had come round. The engine was then at a standstill. When he saw that he was in the middle of nowhere and with no carriages left, the driver realized what had happened. He had no idea how the locomotive had become detached from the rest of the train, but he felt sure that the carriages that had been left behind were in trouble. The driver had no hesitation about what to do. The sensible thing was to continue in the direction of Omaha, to go back towards the train, which the Sioux might still be in the process of ransacking, was fraught with danger. Never mind this. Shovelfuls of coal and wood were heaped into the firebox. The fire got going again. The steam pressure returned, and by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the engine was reversing towards the station at Kearney. This was the whistling noise heard in the fog. The passengers were extremely pleased when they saw the locomotive in place again at the head of the train. They would now be able to continue their journey, which had been so rudely interrupted. When the engine arrived, Mrs. Ayuda came out of the station building and turned to the conductor to ask, "Are you intending to leave?"
"This instant, madam."
"But the prisoners, our unfortunate companions?"
"I can't hold up the service," the conductor replied. "We're already 3 hours late."
"When is the next train from San Francisco due?"
"Tomorrow evening, madam."
"Tomorrow evening will be too late. You must wait."
"It's impossible, madam," answered the conductor. "If you want to leave, please get into the carriage."
"I'm not leaving," said the young woman. Fix had overheard this conversation. A few minutes earlier, when there were no means of transport available, he was determined to leave Kearney. And yet, now that the train was there, ready to depart, and when all he had to do was to go back to his seat in the carriage, he was bound to the spot by an irresistible force. He was itching to get off the station platform, and yet he couldn't tear himself away from it. That inner struggle had started up again. He was overcome by anger at his own failure. He wanted to fight until the bitter end. Meanwhile, the passengers and a few of the wounded, including Colonel Proctor, who was in a serious condition, got into the carriages. The overheated boiler could be heard bubbling away, and steam was escaping from the valves. The driver blew the whistle, the train set off and soon disappeared, its white smoke mingling with the swirling snow. Inspector Fix had stayed behind. Several hours went by. The weather was very bad, the cold biting. Fix was sitting motionless on a bench in the station. Anyone would have thought he was asleep. Despite the gale, Mrs. Ayuda kept on going outside the room that had been placed at her disposal. She walked to the far end of the platform, trying to see through the snowstorm, seeking to pierce the fog that restricted her visibility, listening for any sound she could hear. But there was nothing.
Then she would go back inside, frozen to the bone, only to come out again a few moments later, but still to no avail. Evening came. The small detachment of soldiers had not returned. Where were they at that moment? Had they managed to catch up with the Sioux? Had there been a struggle, or were the soldiers wandering around, lost in the fog? The captain in Fort Kearney was extremely worried, although he didn't want it to show. Night fell. The snow was not so heavy, but the cold grew more intense. The most intrepid of people could not have failed to be overawed by the sight of this immense dark emptiness. Absolute silence filled the plain. There was not a bird in the sky, nor an animal on the prowl to disturb its infinite stillness. All that night, Mrs. Ayuda, whose mind was full of premonitions of disaster and her heart racked with anxiety, wandered about on the edge of the prairie. Her imagination transported her far away and brought her up against a thousand dangers. What she suffered during those long hours cannot be put into words. Fix still remained motionless in the same place, but he too was unable to sleep. At one point, someone went up to him and even said something to him, but the detective sent him away, after replying to him with a shake of the head. The night passed like this. At dawn, the half-extinguished orb of the sun rose above a misty horizon. Nevertheless, visibility was about 2 miles. Phileas Fogg and the detachment of soldiers had headed south. The south was absolutely deserted. By now, it was 7 o'clock in the morning. The captain, who was extremely worried, didn't know what to do. Should he lead a second detachment to come to the aid of the first? Should he sacrifice more men with so little chance of rescuing those who had been sacrificed in the first place? But he did not hesitate for long, and after gesturing towards one of his lieutenants, he was giving him the order to lead a reconnoitering party to the south when there was a burst of gunfire. Was it a signal? The soldiers rushed out of the fort, and half a mile away they noticed a small group of men returning in good order. Mr. Fogg was leading them, and close to him were Passepartout and the 2 other passengers who had been rescued from the clutches of the Sioux. There had been a struggle 10 miles to the south of Fort Kearney. A few moments before the detachment had arrived, Passepartout and his companions were already fighting their captors, and the Frenchman had knocked out 3 of them with his bare fists when his master and the soldiers rushed to their aid. All of them, rescuers and rescued, were greeted with shouts of joy, and Phileas Fogg handed out the promised reward to the soldiers, while Passepartout kept on saying with good reason,
"Really and truly, I'm costing my master a fortune."
Fix didn't say a word, but was looking at Mr. Fogg, and it would have been difficult to analyze the conflicting thoughts then running through his mind. As for Mrs. Ayuda, she had taken the gentleman's hand and was squeezing it between her own, unable to speak. Meanwhile, Passepartout, as soon as he had arrived, had looked for the train in the station. He was expecting to find it there, ready to set off for Omaha at full speed, and he was hoping that they might be able to make up the time lost.
"The train! The train!" he exclaimed.
"It's gone," replied Fix.
"And when is the next train due?" asked Phileas Fogg.
"Not until this evening."
"Oh," was all the impassive gentleman said in reply. Chapter 31, in which Inspector Fix takes Phileas Fogg's interests very much to heart. Phileas Fogg was 20 hours late. Passepartout, who had inadvertently been the cause of this delay, was desperate. He had definitely ruined his master. It was then that the inspector went up to Mr. Fogg and, looking him straight in the eye, asked,
"In all seriousness, sir, are you really in a hurry?"
"I am indeed," replied Phileas Fogg.
"I shall say it again," continued Fix. "Do you really need to be in New York on the 11th of December by 9 o'clock in the evening, when the steamer for Liverpool is due to leave?"
"I really do."
"And if your journey hadn't been interrupted by the Sioux attack, would you have arrived in New York by the morning of the 11th?
"Yes, with 12 hours to spare."
"Good. So you are 20 hours behind. The difference between 20 and 12 is 8. You have 8 hours to make up. Do you want to attempt it?"
"On foot?" asked Mr. Fogg.
"No, by sled,"
replied Fix.
A sled with sails. The man has offered me this means of transport.
It was the man who had spoken to the police inspector during the night, and whose offer Fix had rejected. Phileas Fogg made no reply, but after Fix had pointed out the man in question, who was walking around outside the station, the gentleman went up to him. A moment later, Phileas Fogg and the American, whose name was Mudge, went into a shed below Fort Kearney. There, Mr. Fogg was able to examine a strange-looking vehicle. It was a sort of frame built upon two long beams that were turned up at the end like the runners on a sled, and there was room for about five or six people. A third of the way along the frame to the front stood a very tall mast, to which was attached a huge spanker sail. From this mast, which was firmly held in position by cables, stretched an iron stay, the purpose of which was to hoist a very large jib. At the rear, a sort of oar rudder enabled the contraption to be steered. It was, as can be seen from this description, a sled, but with the rigging of a sloop. In winter, on the icebound plain, when the trains are no longer running because of the snow, these vehicles travel very fast from station to station. What is more, they have an enormous expanse of sail, greater even than a racing cutter, which is liable to capsize, and with the wind behind them, they glide along the surface of the prairies as fast, if not faster, than express trains. Within a few moments, Mr. Fogg and the owner of this land craft had struck a deal. The wind was favourable. It was blowing strongly from the west. The snow had become hard, and Mudge claimed that he could get Mr. Fogg to the station in Omaha in a few hours. From there, it would be easy to get to Chicago and New York, as there are plenty of trains and various lines. It was therefore quite possible that they could make up the time lost. So there was no point in hesitating about whether or not to attempt this adventure. Because he did not want to subject Mrs. Ayuda to the ordeal of an open-air journey in this cold, a situation that could only be made worse by the speed at which they would be travelling, Mr. Fogg suggested to her that she should stay behind under Passepartout's protection at Kearney Station. The trusty fellow would see about bringing her back to Europe by a better route and in more favourable circumstances. Mrs. Ayuda refused to be separated from Mr. Fogg, and Passepartout felt very pleased that she was so definite about this. In any case, he wouldn't have wanted to leave his master for anything in the world, since Fix was to remain with him. What precisely was going through the police inspector's mind at that moment would be difficult to say. Was he less convinced he was right about Fogg now that he had come back, or did he consider him to be an extremely clever crook, who, once he had completed his journey around the world, would be absolutely safe in England? Perhaps Fix's view of Mr. Fogg really had changed, but he was still just as determined to do his duty, and he was more impatient than anyone to do his utmost to speed up their return to England. By 8 o'clock, the sled was ready to leave. The travellers, it would be tempting to call them passengers, took their seats and huddled together under their travel rugs. The two huge sails were hoisted, and with the force of the wind behind it, the vehicle raced over the hardened snow at a rate of 40 knots. The distance separating Fort Kearney from Omaha is, in a straight line, a beeline, as the Americans would say, 200 miles at the most. If the wind held, they would have covered this distance in 5 hours. If there were no problems, the sled should have got to Omaha by 1 o'clock in the afternoon. What a journey it turned out to be. The travellers, huddled up against one another, were unable to speak. The cold, intensified by the speed, would have prevented the words from coming out of their mouths. The sled glided over the surface of the plain as lightly as a vessel over the surface of the water, minus the swell. When the wind came skimming along the ground, it looked as if the sled would be lifted into the air by its sails, huge wings with a vast span. Mudge, at the rudder, kept it going straight, and with a touch on the oar, he prevented the contraption from veering to one side, which it had a tendency to do. All the sails caught the wind. The jib had been perked and was no longer shielded by the spanker. A topmast was hoisted, and a topsail, put out into the wind, added its driving force to the other sails. It was impossible to work it out exactly, but the sled must certainly have attained a speed of no less than 40 knots.
"If nothing gives way," said Mudge, "we'll make it!"
It was in Mudge's interest to arrive within the deadline because Mr. Fogg, in keeping with his normal practice, had given him the incentive of a hefty bonus. The prairie which the sled was directly cutting across was as flat as the sea. It looked like an enormous frozen pond. The railroad that served this part of the territory went up from the southwest to the northwest via Grand Island, Columbus, a sizable town in Nebraska, Shiloh, Fremont, and then Omaha. It followed the right bank of the Platte River for the whole of the way. The sled took a shorter route, going in a straight line instead of following the curve chosen by the railroad. There was no need for Mudge to fear being stopped by the Platte River at the small bend it makes before Fremont, because its waters were frozen over. The way was therefore completely free of obstacles, and so there were only two things for Phileas Fogg to be afraid of: damage to the craft and a change of direction or drop in the wind. But the wind did not slacken. Far from it, it blew so hard as to bend the mast, which was firmly supported by the iron cables. These metal wires resounded as if they were the strings of a musical instrument being played with a bow. The sled sped along to the accompaniment of this plaintive harmony, which had an exceptional intensity about it.
"These chords are in fifths and octaves," said Mr. Fogg.
These were the only words he uttered during the whole journey. Mrs. Ayuda, who was carefully wrapped up in furs and travel rugs, was as far as possible protected from the effects of the cold. Passepartout, meanwhile, his face as red as the setting sun seen through the mist, was breathing in the sharp air. With that unshakable confidence that was an essential part of his makeup, he had started to hope again. Instead of getting to New York in the morning, they would get there in the evening, but there was still a possibility that this would be before the steamer for Liverpool left. Passepartout had even felt a strong desire to shake hands with his ally Fix. He hadn't forgotten that it was the inspector himself who had got hold of the sailing sled, and therefore the only possible means of reaching Omaha in time. But because of some strange premonition, he remained guarded towards Fix as usual. In any case, there was one thing that Passepartout would never forget, and that was the sacrifice that Mr. Fogg had made, without any hesitation, in rescuing him from the Sioux. In so doing, Mr. Fogg had risked his fortune and his life. No, his servant would never forget that. While these various thoughts occupied the minds of each traveller, the sled was flying on across the immense carpet of snow. They hardly had time to notice as they went past the few creeks, tributaries and sub-tributaries of the Little Blue River. The fields and watercourses were covered by a uniform whiteness. The plain was absolutely deserted. Covering the whole area between the Union Pacific Railroad and the branch line that is intended to link Kearney and St. Joseph, it formed what seemed a huge desert island. There was not a single village or station, or even a fort. From time to time, a gruesome-looking tree flashed by, its white skeleton twisting in the wind. Sometimes flocks of birds took flight all at the same time. Sometimes, too, large packs of prairie wolves, thin and hungry, and driven on by some fearsome need, tried to outrun the sled. At moments such as these, Passepartout, with his revolver in his hand, stood ready to fire at the animals that got nearest. If an accident of some sort had brought the sled to a standstill at such times, the travellers would have been attacked by these fierce carnivores and would have been in considerable danger. But the sled stood the strain and soon raced ahead, leaving the whole pack howling behind it. By midday, Mudge recognized the telltale signs that he was following the frozen course of the Platte River. He didn't say anything, but he was already convinced that 20 miles further on, he would reach the station at Omaha. And sure enough, less than an hour later, this skillful guide left the helm, rushed to the halyards and lowered the sails, while the sled, carried along by its own momentum, travelled another 30 miles with all its sails taken in. At last it came to a standstill, and Mudge, pointing to a collection of snow-covered roofs, said,
"We've arrived!"
They had indeed arrived at this station, which has frequent trains and a daily service to the east of the United States. Passepartout and Fix had jumped out of the vehicle and were moving about to get their circulation back. They helped Mr. Fogg and Mrs. Ayuda to get out of the sled. Phileas Fogg paid Mudge handsomely, and Passepartout shook his hand as if they had been old friends, and they all rushed off towards Omaha Station. This important city in Nebraska is where the Pacific Railroad, properly speaking, comes to an end, linking the Mississippi Basin to the ocean. To go from Omaha to Chicago, the railway, known as the Chicago-Rock Island Railroad, runs directly east, serving 50 stations on the way. A direct train was about to leave. Phileas Fogg and his companions just had time to jump into a carriage. They hadn't seen anything of Omaha, but Passepartout admitted to himself that this was no cause for regret, because it wasn't the time for sightseeing. At great speed, the train crossed into the state of Iowa via Council Bluffs, Des Moines, and Iowa City. During the night, it crossed the Mississippi at Davenport and entered Illinois via Rock Island. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the following day, the 10th, it reached Chicago, which had already risen again out of its ruins, looking more impressive than ever in its position overlooking the beautiful Lake Michigan. There are 900 miles between Chicago and New York. There was no shortage of trains in Chicago. Mr. Fogg went straight from one train to another. The frisky locomotive of the Pittsburgh, Fort Wayne, Chicago Railroad set off at full speed, as if it was fully aware that the honorable gentleman had no time to lose. It went like lightning through Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, passing through towns with classical-sounding names, some having streets and tramcars, but as yet no houses. At last the Hudson came into view, and on the 11th of December at 11:15 in the evening, the train pulled up in the station, on the right bank of the river, just in front of the pier for the steamers of the Cunard Line, in other words, the British and North American Royal Mail Steam Packet Company. The China, bound for Liverpool, had left 45 minutes earlier. Chapter 32, in which Phileas Fogg squares up to misfortune. The China's departure seemed to signal the end of all Phileas Fogg's hopes. No other steamer plying the direct route from America to Europe could further the gentleman's plans. This applied to the French transatlantic steamers, the ships of the White Star Line, the steamers of the Inman Company, those of the Hamburg Line, and any others. In particular, the Pereire, belonging to the French transatlantic company, whose excellent ships were equal in speed and superior in comfort to those of every other line, didn't leave for another 2 days, the 14th of December. In any case, like the ships of the Hamburg Line, it didn't go directly to Liverpool or London, but to Le Havre, and the additional crossing from Le Havre to Southampton would have caused Phileas Fogg further delay, thereby rendering his final efforts useless. As for the steamers of the Inman Company, one of them, the City of Paris, was setting to sea the following day, but it was pointless even thinking about it. These ships were used mainly for the transport of emigrants, and so their engines lacked power. They used sail power as much as steam, and their speed was poor. With them, the crossing from New York to England took longer than the time that was left to Mr. Fogg if he was to win his bet. The gentleman was perfectly aware of all this from reading his Bradshaw, which gave him detailed information about ocean sailings across the globe for every day of the year. Passepartout felt completely devastated. To have missed the steamer by 45 minutes was a terrible blow for him. It was all his fault. Instead of helping his master, all he'd done was to keep putting obstacles in his way. And when he cast his mind back over all that had happened during the journey, when he worked out the sums of money spent for nothing and just on him, when he reflected that this huge bet, not to mention the considerable costs of this now pointless voyage, had completely ruined Mr. Fogg financially, he was furious with himself. Mr. Fogg, however, made no criticism of him, and as he left the pier for the transatlantic steamers, he merely said, "We shall decide what to do tomorrow. Come along." Mr. Fogg, Mrs. Ayuda, Fix, and Passepartout crossed the Hudson in the Jersey City ferry and then got into a cab which drove them to the St. Nicholas Hotel on Broadway. Rooms were found for them and they spent the night there. It went quickly for Phileas Fogg, who slept soundly, but it went much more slowly for Mrs. Ayuda and her companions, whose minds were so agitated that they didn't get much rest. The next day was the 12th of December. From 7 o'clock in the morning on the 12th to 8:45 in the evening on the 21st, there were 9 days, 13 hours, and 45 minutes remaining. So if Phileas Fogg had set off the previous day on the China, one of the fastest ships of the Cunard Line, he would have arrived in Liverpool and then in London within the deadline. Mr. Fogg left the hotel alone after having instructed his servant to wait for him and to inform Mrs. Ayuda that she should be ready to depart at any moment. Mr. Fogg went along to the banks of the Hudson, and among the ships moored along the quaysides or at anchor in the river, he searched out carefully those that were ready to sail. Several vessels had their departure flags flying and were ready to set to sea on the morning tide. Not a single day goes by in this enormous and magnificent port of New York without 100 ships setting out for destinations all over the world. But most of them were sailing ships and were not suitable for Mr. Fogg's purposes. The gentleman's final attempt seemed condemned to failure when suddenly he saw, moored in front of the battery no more than a cable's length away, a propeller-driven commercial vessel with elegant lines and with clouds of smoke coming out of its funnel, the sign that it was getting ready to sail. Phileas Fogg hailed a rowing boat, got in, and after a few strokes on the oars, had reached the ladder of the Henrietta, a steamer with an iron hull, but with all its upper works made of wood. The captain of the Henrietta was on board. Phileas Fogg climbed onto the bridge and asked for him. He appeared immediately. He was a man of about 50, a sort of sea dog, a grumpy individual who certainly couldn't be easy to deal with. He had bulging eyes, a rusty copper-colored complexion, red hair, and a neck like a bull's. There was nothing sophisticated about his appearance. "Are you the captain?" asked Phileas Fogg.
"That's me."
"I am Phileas Fogg from London."
"I'm Andrew Speedy from Cardiff."
"Are you about to leave?"
"In an hour."
"Where are you making for?"
"Bordeaux."
"What are you carrying?"
"Stones in the belly, no freight leaving with ballast."
"Do you have any passengers?"
"No passengers, never take passengers. Too cumbersome, too argumentative."
"Does your ship go well?"
11 to 12 knots, the Henrietta. Well known."
"Will you take me and 3 other people to Liverpool?"
"To Liverpool? Why not China?"
"I said Liverpool."
"No."
"No?"
"No. I'm leaving for Bordeaux, and Bordeaux's where I'm going."
"At any price?"
"At any price."
The captain had spoken and wasn't to be contradicted. "But the owners of the Henrietta," continued Phileas Fogg.
"The owner's me," replied the captain. "It's my ship."
"I'll charter it from you."
"No."
"I'll buy it from you."
"No."
Phileas Fogg didn't bat an eyelid. However, the situation was serious. New York wasn't the same thing as Hong Kong, and dealing with the captain of the Henrietta wasn't the same thing as dealing with the skipper of the Tankadera. So far, the gentleman's money had always been able to overcome obstacles. This time, money didn't work. Nevertheless, it was essential to find a way of crossing the Atlantic by boat, unless they could get across in a hot air balloon, which would have been very risky and, in any case, was not practical. It looked, however, as if Phileas Fogg had an idea, because he said to the captain, "Well then, will you take me to Bordeaux?"
"No, not even if you paid me $200.
"I am offering you $2,000.
"Per person?"
"Per person."
"And there are 4 of you?"
"4. Captain Speedy began to scratch his forehead as if he was intent on tearing all the skin off it. Earning $8,000 without changing his route made it worth putting aside his aversion to having passengers on board. In any case, passengers at $2,000 a go are no longer passengers but valuable cargo.
"I'm leaving at 9 o'clock, he said briefly. "And if you and yours are there..."
"By 9 o'clock, we'll be on board," Phileas Fogg replied, just as briefly. It was 8:30. With a calm that never deserted him, whatever the circumstances, the gentleman got off the Henrietta, took a carriage, went to the St. Nicholas Hotel, and brought back Mrs. Ayuda, Passepartout, and the inseparable Fix, whose crossing he kindly offered to pay for. By the time the Henrietta set sail, the 4 of them were on board. When Passepartout discovered the cost of this latest crossing, he let out the sort of extended "Oh!" that goes through every interval on the descending chromatic scale. As for Inspector Fix, he thought to himself that the Bank of England was really going to come off badly from this business. The truth was that by the time they arrived, and even supposing that this fellow Fogg didn't throw a few more fistfuls of dollars overboard, there would still be more than £7,000 missing from the bag of banknotes. Chapter 33, where Phileas Fogg proves himself equal to the situation. An hour later, the steamer, the Henrietta, passed the lightship marking the mouth of the Hudson, went around the headland of Sandy Hook, and put out to sea. During the day, it followed the coastline of Long Island, keeping well clear of the beacon on Fire Island, then headed rapidly eastwards. At midday on the following day, the 13th of December, a man climbed onto the bridge to take the ship's bearings. It would seem safe to assume that this man was Captain Speedy. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was Phileas Fogg, Esquire. Captain Speedy, meanwhile, was quite simply locked up in his cabin and was howling away, giving vent to a quite understandable anger that was reaching fever pitch. What had happened was perfectly simple. Phileas Fogg wanted to get to Liverpool, but the captain didn't want to take him there. Phileas Fogg had then agreed to travel to Bordeaux, and during the 30 hours he'd been on board, he had put his banknotes to work so effectively that the crew, the sailors and the stokers, a motley collection of individuals who were on pretty bad terms with the captain, had been won over. This is why Phileas Fogg was in command instead of Captain Speedy, why the captain was locked up in his cabin, and, lastly, why the Henrietta was heading for Liverpool. It was, though, very clear from the way he set about things that Mr. Fogg had been a sailor. It was too early to tell how things would work out. However, Mrs. Ayuda was worried without letting it show. Fix had been simply dumbfounded to start with. As for Passepartout, he found the whole thing absolutely wonderful.
"Between 11 and 12 knots,
was what Captain Speedy had said, and sure enough, the Henrietta kept up this average speed. And so if, but there were lots of ifs, the sea didn't get too rough, if the wind didn't veer to the east, if the vessel was spared accidental damage and mechanical breakdown, it was possible for the Henrietta to cover the 3,000 miles separating New York and Liverpool in the 9 days between the 12th and the 21st of December. It is true that once he'd arrived, the business of the Henrietta coming on top of the business at the Bank of England could well cause the gentleman more complications than he'd like. For the first few days, conditions for sailing were excellent. The sea wasn't too difficult, the wind seemed settled in the northeast, the sails were set, and under its trysails, the Henrietta went like a real transatlantic steamer. Passepartout was delighted. He was full of enthusiasm for his master's latest exploit, though he didn't want to think about its consequences. The crew had never seen such a high-spirited and nimble fellow. He was very friendly towards the sailors and amazed them with his acrobatics. He treated them to compliments and tempting-looking drinks. For him, they went about their work like gentlemen, and the stokers stoked like heroes. Everyone was susceptible to his infectious good humour. He'd forgotten about the recent past, the problems and the dangers. The only thing he thought about was the goal that they were so close to reaching. And sometimes he was boiling over with impatience, as if he'd been heated up by the Henrietta's own furnace. The worthy fellow often circled around Fix, looking at him knowingly but not saying a word, because there was no longer any closeness between the two former friends. In any case, it had to be said that Fix no longer had a clue about what was going on. This whole sequence of events, the takeover of the Henrietta, the bribing of the crew, and Fogg navigating like an experienced sailor, had him baffled. He just didn't know what to think. But after all, a gentleman who started out by stealing £55,000 could easily end up stealing a sailing ship. And Fix naturally went on to conclude that, under Phileas Fogg's command, the Henrietta was not heading for Liverpool at all, but for some other part of the world, where the thief, who had now turned into a pirate, could safely spend the rest of his life. It has to be admitted that this was a perfectly plausible explanation, and the detective was beginning seriously to regret ever having got caught up in this business. Meanwhile, Captain Speedy continued to howl away in his cabin, and Passepartout, who had been given the task of providing him with food, only did so with the greatest of caution, despite his own physical strength. Mr. Fogg, on the other hand, no longer seemed to suspect there was a captain on board. On the 13th, they reached the tail end of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. These are dangerous waters, especially during the winter. Fog is common, and the storms are frightening. The previous day, the barometer had dropped suddenly, a sign that a change in the weather was imminent. And sure enough, during the night, the temperature changed. The